Central thesis of the book. A few rejoinders by Morris Wee, and then Walt Bowman will try to sort out the pieces and we'll move from there. So we'll proceed forthwith with Leland's opening remarks.
This is a verbal community I'm up here with. I know that it'll be hard to get in one's words in later on, so I probably will go on for a long time here. I don't know.
I'll let you on.
As a kind of preface to it all, I want to read something that Carl Stady gave it to me some years ago. And I found it in my stuff last year and started using it and found people wanting copies of it all over the place. And it occurs to me that it's one way of talking about the theme of this book. I'll just read it and maybe it'll be relevant, maybe it won't, but keep it around. The author is Ann Herbert. In the beginning, God didn't make just two people. He made a bunch of us. Because he wanted us to have a lot of fun, and he said, you can't really have fun unless there's a whole gang of you. He put us in Eden, which was a combination of garden and playground and park, and paid us to have fun. At first we did have fun, just like we expected. We rolled down the hills, waded in the streams, climbed on the trees, swung on the vines, ran in the meadows, frolicked in the woods, hid in the forest, and acted silly. I thought it would fit Hogan. We laughed a lot. Then one day, this snake told us we weren't having real fun because we weren't keeping still. Maybe I don't have to read anymore. Back then, we didn't know what score was. Okay. When he explained it, we still couldn't see the fun. But he said we should give an answer to the person who is best at all the games, and we never know who is best without keeping score. We could all see the fun of that, of course, because we were all sure we were best. It is different after that. We yelled a lot. We had to make up new scoring rules for most of the game. Others, like frolicking, we stopped playing because they were too hard to score. By the time God found out what had happened, we were spending about 45 minutes a day actually playing and the rest of the time working out scoring. God was wroth about that, very, very wroth. He said he couldn't use his garden anymore because he weren't having fun. We told him we were having lots of fun. He was just being narrow-minded because it wasn't exactly the kind of fun he originally thought of. He wouldn't listen. He kicked us out. And he said we couldn't come back until we stopped keeping score. To rub it in, to get our attention, he said, he told us we were all going to die and our scores wouldn't mean anything anyway. He was wrong. My community, all game score now is 16,548, and that means a lot to me. If I can raise it to 20,000 before I die, I'll know I've accomplished something. Even if I can't, my life has a great deal of meaning because I've taught my children to score high, and they'll be able to reach 20,000 or even 30,000. Well, it was life in the garden that didn't mean anything. Fun is great in its place, but without scoring, there's no reason for it. God actually has a very superficial view of life, and I'm certainly glad my children are being raised away from his influence. We were lucky. We were all very grateful to the snake.
I think Paul begins
built his book on an assumption that life has a lot of anxiety or potential anxiety in it, terror maybe. I suppose we were meant to depend on God, trust in God with all our heart and soul and mind, and that's the only way we can live. But Paul looks at the culture in our day and sees, with the help of existentialists, that we're kind of shook up as human beings. And one of our basic responses to that is that we strive for mastery, for success. And one thing about our particular time is that we have the tools to make it look like we can master ourselves and our world and achieve success and probably do it on a horizontal level. Anyway, that's my way of sort of summarizing starting to summarize the first half of the book. The words he uses are experience and expectation. And he says there has to be a balance between experience and expectation. Both of them have to be taken into account. He sees that in the American dream, and I would submit that the tendency is very strong for all human beings to do this, that we try to leap into some sort of ideal, some sort of safe place of victory, of triumph, of where we've got it all together, a theology of glory. And that what tends to happen is that the proclamation of the resurrection tends to fall into the trap, be gathered into that trap of being part of the theology of glory. So that expectation, as it were, the expectation side, the ideal side, takes us away from the real struggles of being human and the real problems of the world, and we can sort of zip into or pop into this new realm of expectation, of being sort of away from reality, above it, of having success, of thinking positively, and you think positively long enough and hard enough and well enough, this is the way to be fully human, and this is a way to be fully American, and this is the way to deal with life's problems. Paul sees this approach to things as doing quite a bit of mischief, and says that it's time to come forth with the truth about what's going on, and to make Christianity viable again, get us back to the basic message of the cross. A theology of the cross rather than a theology of glory. And he goes back to Martin Luther for this one and builds a whole lot on the last recorded words of Luther, we are beggars, that is true. And he speaks about that as a human being and as a theologian. Don't worry, nothing's going to turn out all right. Is Paul Harvey's way of saying it. I'm very tempted to read a whole lot of passages that highlight how this works, but I'm afraid I might get cut off here pretty soon. There's a kind of triumphalism in the Christian faith we have inherited that renders it inaccessible to an age when triumph is hardly a characteristic experience of man. When, on the contrary, the strongest and most sensitive men experience an inextinguishable sense of melancholy and apprehension that is no longer susceptible to the cures of the Enlightenment. While you think about that one, I will go on. He does speak throughout the book, he is saying over and over again that he does not want to deny the triumph of Christianity, he doesn't deny the resurrection. But his point is the only way to that, from the beginning of the Christian way till now, is via the cross. It's cross and resurrection. It must not be overlooked that the whole intention of this theology is to bear witness to the incarnation. The theology of the cross is first of all a way of speaking about the character of God's entry into the sphere of human history. It is not merely a statement about the death of Jesus, but about the life and meaning of his life for our lives. It is not merely a statement about the human condition. It is a testimony to the assumption of the human condition by the one who created and creates out of nothing. The basic point of this theology is not to reveal that our condition is one of darkness and death. It is to reveal to us the one who meets us in our darkness and death. It is a theology of the cross, not because it wants to put forward this ghastly spectacle as a final statement about life in the world, but because it insists that God, who wills to meet us, love us, redeems us, meets, loves, and redeems us precisely where we are, in the valley of the shadow of death, is the repudiation of the theology of glory, not because it is fundamentally masochistic and mistrusts or despises man's search for happiness, but because it insists that authentic happiness can only be found as we confront and enter into that which, under the conditions of existence, negates and dispels happiness. Blessed are the poor, those who mourn, the hungry, the persecuted. We've heard some of this already today. The theology of the cross declares God is with you, Emmanuel. He is alongside you in your suffering. He is in the darkest place of your dark night. You do not have to look for him in the sky, beyond the stars, in infinite light, in glory unimaginable. He is incarnate. That means he has been crucified. For to become flesh, to become one of us, means not only to be born, but also to die, to fail. But it means that he has been crucified, and therefore that the way of the cross, which is in any case our way, need not be regarded as any longer producing only negative results. So he is saying that it's there, in the middle of our struggles, whether they're personal, familial, political, whatever, in the defeats and failures, that's where you meet Christ. That's where he has chosen to join us. As far as ethics is concerned, he says that, which is probably the biggest question that people will have about this point of view, is that, well, I'll just read this much of it. The point of departure for the ethics of the cross is not merely an axiom, a lesson, an insight. It is not merely the concept that God's work in the world always reflects creation out of nothing, the resurrection of the dead, the justification of the unrighteous. The point of departure is rather the subjection of the Christian and the Christian koinonia to the experience of the cross. Not only once, but in a continuous baptism, the beginning of the ethic of the cross is the identification of the people with the crucified one, is the reduction of the people to nothing, beggarliness and brokenness. Only through that reduction, continuously accomplished, is it possible for this people to be truly identified with God's work in the world. Thus, the point of departure for this social ethic may be the only one that is finally legitimate, even in terms that secular men such as Marxists can recognize, namely a real solidarity with those who suffer. Only as the Christian community commits itself to undergo a continuous crucifixion to the world can it be in the world as a friend of those who are crucified. Apart from that, it always ends in a theology and an ethic of glory, a business about, well, we're going to do something for those poor people over there who don't have it quite as good as we do. The theology of the cross, the ethic of the theology of the cross, subjects us to the same conditions. There's more things that I'd like to go on with. I'll probably get it in eventually, but I'll stop at this point.
Okay. Morris, what do you have to say to that?
Okay. Well, I'm in the unenviable position of standing in opposition to this work that's been chosen as the theme for the summer. And I'm sitting next to the man who chose it. So I'm going to have to be careful about the way I talk about the book. But I have three objections to make to it, and I hope to present them clearly enough to make my point, though I haven't got the passages to use, and Lee, you can correct me if I'm being unfair to Hull. My first objection is the most trivial of the three, and it has to do with Hull's tone of voice in this book. He reminds me of a preacher who says, none of you are ever going to get to heaven if you keep sinning the way you're sinning. He seems to exclude himself from the things he's talking about. He rarely does he say, we in the church have to work on this, but rather the North American church has to work on this. And he is speaking sometimes as a prophet, and a prophet has to be has to say things that are objectionable that we don't want to hear, and quite often exempts himself or herself from what she's saying. But I objected to that from the start. And it's linked to my second objection, and that is that in order to criticize the church in North America and to shake us up, I think he radically oversimplifies the nature of the church. He talks about the Christian church in North America as the officially optimistic church of an officially optimistic society. And in so doing, I think he in a sense sets up a straw church so it'd be easier to blow down. I get the feeling that his congregation must be in some affluent suburb and still caught in the 50s before anything began to happen in the 60s and 70s. I don't know. But the way he links the Christian churches in North America with the government surprises me. I find it hard to sympathize with his idea that all of the churches are buying into the ethic of the government or the world view of the government, which is to be officially optimistic and to have high expectations and to continue to increase one's point total and so forth. That's not been my experience in the churches, and I think he's really unfair to the churches to generalize and to say they've all bought into this system, which really sounds more like, and in fact he makes explicitly links it to what was called the broad church in England in the 19th century. Maybe I think there's some truth to that linkage and some truth to thinking of our churches as having the kind of simple optimism that I tend to associate with the suburbs in the 50s. But I don't think it's true of the churches today. I think the churches have a much, the churches I've been acquainted with have a much clearer image of the difficulties of our times, of the evil in the world, of the complexity of the things we're working with, and are struggling to find ways of confronting that darkness. My third point, my third objection, oh, let me say, in addition, he assumes from the beginning that we as a culture in the West and in North America are confronting an abyss. We're just one step from the end. We're about to fall over the edge. He doesn't ever, I don't think, justify that position, but he says that is what the churches are failing to look at. They're still preaching optimism when we're about to fall into the abyss. Not quite explaining whether he means loss of faith, sense of meaninglessness, or lack of food and ecology problems, overpopulation, or what. I'm not quite sure why he sees the abyss as particularly deep right now, but Walt will explain that. Now, my third objection is, I think Lee touched on this when he said he does talk about the need for a balance between expectation and experience, between the dream or the vision and the awareness of the evil in the world of the darkness that we're living in. I think in the book he gives insufficient emphasis to that need for vision. He talks about, yes, all human beings hope, but any person with any sense hopes with an awareness of failure, with the sense that, you know, knowledge that people have always failed. And our churches don't seem to be doing that. He really de-emphasizes the need for vision. And in a session I had earlier when I was objecting to Hall with the support of modern American literature, somebody, I thought, very wisely pointed out that Christ certainly lived with a kind of a crazy vision that did not, in any logical terms, account for the realities of the world. Yes, he lived, he suffered, he hung around with all the disorders and unsavory people in society, but he always had a vision that isn't easily accounted for by the things he had to deal with at hand. And Paul seems to overlook the need for that kind of vision in order to live in the society we're in. The final contradiction of his book is that at the end he tries to make some point, some means of being hopeful, and he says there is some potential in the counterculture, I'll call it counterculture of the 60s, and growing out of that, perhaps there will be a chance for a real shift, a shift away from this optimism in our society and an encounter with the darkness. He doesn't point out that the kinds of idealism that were required and have been required for that whole anti-war movement, the back to the earth movement, a kind of counterculture, that it requires the same kind of optimism that the or idealism, vision, that the thing that it's overthrowing required, and that in fact that idealism grows out of an idealism that has always been present in North American culture and makes it possible for someone to say, yes, we can make this a different world, we can have a vision like Christ's vision of a new age.
Thanks, Morris. I think those rejoinders are substantive and enough to chew on. Walt's been jotting some notes.
I counted four objections, not three.
Yeah, I amplified.
Let me just try to say that it seems to me Hall's inability, well, I didn't see, first of all, the inability to define the abyss. I think he does do that. I think he says that, I think he sees the abyss in two, coming at us in two forms. One is that our attempt at mastery, or our pursuit of inauthentic mastery, is bad for us, bad for our relationships with each other, and bad for our world. Like the scorekeeping that Lee read about in his initial comment. So I think he tries to make the case, at least, that our necessity to compete with each other and to have mastery over our world, in a sense, has led really to the ravaging of the planet, first of all, just in ecological terms.
So that abyss is the same thing we've been moving toward from the Renaissance.
Yes.
And he seemed to imply that we're right at the edge now, and that's one thing I was wondering about. Why, you know, how does he see that? Maybe.
Well, I don't want to pull rank at this point, or not rank, but just assume an unfair advantage.
Yes,
but his, earlier, the book that he did just a year earlier, The Reality of the Gospel and the Unreality of the Churches, has a fairly extensive section in it, in which he talks about the fact that just at a time when the church's gospel, its proclamation, might be most received, not by not just by religious people, but by people who are really looking at the abyss, the church is piddling around in unreality. And here he identifies and quotes extensively from people who have no religious interests at all, who are not in any technical or accepted sense theologians, people who are saying we really are at the end of our possibilities, and the optimism that we are living with is really a foolhardy, illusory, deadly. He's not here simply quoting a religious prophet who needs to make everybody feel bad so that he can make them feel good, who says, beat yourself with a hammer so that it feels good when you stop. He's quoting people. I brought Heilbronner along just as one, although he doesn't make very much of Heilbronner. But Heilbronner's inquiry into the human prospect is really a kind of devastating look at our own future. John Schramm has quoted businessmen who are saying, we know we can't go on much longer as we have. Heilbronner's point is that we're running out of the resources that have fueled our culture, that there's probably, that we don't have very many years left to live the way we are trying to live right now, and that the consequences of this are either going to be a totalitarian government that will force us to pull back from where we are, or a totalitarian government equally reprehensible that will attempt to have us preserve what we have, no matter at whose expense, for a few more years. We're not going to go on much longer watching the decline of the dollar. We'll just seize Saudi Arabia, or they will buy us out, or whatever. Something is going to happen. But at any event, we will probably have a kind of totalitarian regime to take and hold on to what we have as long as we can, even though it can't be very much longer. So that's at least one half of the abyss. It's that we are in fact doing terrible things to world, to others, and in the last analysis also to ourselves, with the kind of pursuits that we have. And I think that the other half of the abyss that he is looking at is that we are ill-equipped in fact, totally unequipped to deal with the realities of the world in which we live. We are not able to hold out an authentic vision. We have an inauthentic one. And the inauthenticity of our vision is evidenced by the fact that we cannot really cope with the darkness that does exist, the failure to which we are all subject. We cannot deal with death, we cannot deal with defeat, and we can't deal with weakness. The evidences for this, it seems to me, in the churches now. He's not talking about our culture's failure. That, you know, that's another matter, and that may not even be our responsibility. But he's talking about the failure of the churches to do this. Examples. People withdraw from the church at the point at which they fail. It isn't so much that they turn to the churches, but that's the point at which they withdraw from the church. I'm not good enough to be a part of the church. So that it is precisely at the moment of our failures, our weaknesses, our sins, the places where we have been caught, that's the point at which we withdraw from the church, because somehow or other people perceive the church as the place where everything is all right, where the put-together types really get together. The church is the last place where sin is exposed. For all our talking about it, it's the last place where real sinners can be found, either in terms of confession or in terms of support and encouragement and
shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even of the things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. The irony is that these scenes were not and are not experienced as being in the least ironic. And Kierkegaard had the same thoughts about Denmark. Evidently, and this, these passages were also dear to Luther. Evidently, there is an overturning here. There is a transvaluation of values. It's saying, make sure what you're boasting in when you're feeling good about yourself, and so on. It's growing out of grace, not something that you have achieved, not something you put together, that not, you've not earned your particular spot in this excellent fellowship.
Let me just try to tell two stories. I want to celebrate, first of all of the places where the church really does become a community of support in the midst of our failure. We don't have to cultivate divorces among clergy or drinking problems to qualify. We have enough other failures to be able to deal with. But let me tell two stories. A couple of years ago, we had a student from South India at the seminary, and I went around to a bunch of parishes and raised some money for this student, and one of the checks bounced. And so I waited a couple of weeks and then called the pastor of that parish, and I said, among other things in the conversation, by the way, the check you sent us for so-and-so bounced. Oh, he said, I'm glad to know that. He said, we've been trying to discover all these checks. I want to tell you what's happened. This is a small parish, 100 families, less than 100 families. He said, our treasurer has embezzled $15,000. And, you know, I was just stunned. And then as he told the story, it got even more complicated. The man had lost his job. Couldn't find another job, couldn't face his wife and children with loss of job, and couldn't come to the parish either with loss of job. So since he was treasurer, he just embezzled over a period of almost a year $15,000, most of it from the church's debt retirement fund, that is, from their mortgage to the bank, but picking and choosing those checks that he didn't think could be easily traced as ways in which to cover the embezzling. I said to my friend, you know, what are you going to do with all this? He said, I don't know. He said, it's more complicated than that. We've got insurance, but only if we prosecute this guy can we collect. Well, they agonized for 2 months, finally decided not to prosecute, and they worked it out as best they could, and people came up with money so that they could get the bank out of the picture and a few other things. And but it wasn't just simply a case of not prosecuting a fellow Christian. They really worked at attempting to restore with all that meant. Now, this is about 3 years ago now that it's happened. And my last conversation with the pastor just before we left is that it's working. I mean, they put together some psychiatric help for him, first of all, some family counseling. I was at the church about a year and a half ago when the man's daughter was confirmed, a great celebration. They stayed with that parish. He's got a job again. He's paying back the money so that it isn't, I guess I worried as we were talking here that what was going to happen was kind of cheap condoning. One of Lewis's best quotes is that of all the powers, God forgives the most and condones the least. You know, and how we put that together, it seems to me, is part of what we need to be talking about. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's one of the stories that needs to be told. I think that's a value to be cultivated. But I guess all the studies I have at my disposal indicate that those are the kind of rare examples. I hope they're not all too rare, and I will rejoice with every story you can tell like that. But the big picture. The other story I wanted to tell concerns the religion of the Midwest, football, and and a poignant picture. Michigan and Ohio State were playing for the annual championship of the Big Ten. I don't know what they do with the other 8 teams, but they were playing, and Michigan's field goal kicker missed a couple of crucial field goals, and Ohio State won the game. And what was really poignant for me was the shots that the television cameras focused on. There was one quick shot that I don't think they were really supposed to let on. It was the Michigan field goal kicker sitting all alone on the bench after he had missed his field goal. Not a soul within 10 feet of this guy, you know. I was reminded of Kennedy's statement about victory having 1,000 friends and defeat having none. And the contrast to that was the Ohio State field goal kicker who had just won the game with a field goal, mobbed by everybody. The time at which you need nobody is when you've kicked the field goal. The time when you need everybody is when you've missed. But we just reverse that. We all want to be in on the victory, and I do it, you know, that's the most terrible thing. I want to be in on the good things and I want to avoid the bad things. But it's just the reverse of what it is. What would it be like if we cultivated the pursuit of excellence, you see, in ways that weren't so much scorekeeping? What if we cultivated the pursuit of our personal ability to live with ourselves, to handle leisure time, to fight par at golf or bowl against 300 instead of against somebody else? You know, I just wonder what it might be like if we could, if those were the kinds of things we cultivated, and if the time to rally round somebody was when he blew it and not when he really didn't need it, when he had made it. No, when I have preached a good sermon, I don't need anybody to tell me it was good. I know it. it's the lousy ones that I need people to stand around and say, we love you anyway.
I have two lines and then I'll stop. In a dark time, the eye begins to see. Faith is fear that says its prayers.
And the second comment I wanted to make is that no vision can be articulated in a vacuum, since the world is a fallen world, a broken world. No vision can be articulated without also saying something has to die. And I think the questions that we have to confront are, you know, what's got to die in order for a vision to come into being? In the last analysis, every positive statement has to say something's got to go. So I think even the vision of the 60s had to say its vision at the expense of something else. That was at least part of the trauma of the intergenerational conflict, because parents were meeting children who were repudiating parental values. There is no way that you can affirm something in the kind of world in which we're in today without something else dying. And I think, therefore, we've got to ask, what needs to die? Even the mastery vision is mastery at someone else's expense. The theology of the cross tries to say, what's got to die? Some things in me have to die. An old self in me has to die. An old age has to die. So that even Jesus' vision comes at an expense, not at the expense now of the firstborn from Egypt. In his exodus, it will be at the expense of the only begotten of the Father. And those who follow him are also called to be part of the cost. Something in us dies so that there will be a new vision. And I think that's the kind of thing Lee was trying to articulate.
I almost felt like crying when you were talking about the churches and, you know, the thing about burial and marriages falling apart and those people not being the ones that can go to the church, partly because of my own personal family situation. And it seems to be the way it is, at least the way it is in a large parish in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where I'm from. And I'm also speaking at the end of my first year in seminary and feeling like most of my struggles have been struggles with myself and what I see are my weaknesses. And I was just wondering if there were any pastors here that could speak to that, what Walt was saying about. I mean, do you see it happening in parishes or church members? Maybe? I would be really interested.
How about failure of driving people from the churches?
Yeah. Not being the place where you can go to be honest about failures in your life or things going wrong, illnesses, whatever.
If I can just hook on to that with a passage from Hall. The test of theological authenticity is whether we can present Jesus as the crucified. To be concrete, can one perceive in Jesus of this theology a man who knows the meaning of meaninglessness, the experience of negation, the anguish of hopelessness? Does he encounter the absurd with trembling? Would a man dare to confess to this Jesus his deepest anxieties, his most ultimate questions? Would such a Jesus comprehend the gnawing care of a generation of parents who live every day with the questions, will my children be able to survive as human beings in the year 1984, 2001, 2026? Will there be enough to eat? Will they be permitted to have children? Would he, the God-man of this theology, be able to weep over the dead bodies of little children in Southeast Asia and Brazil as he wept over his friend Lazarus? Could he participate in the anguish and the anger of those who know why the little children died? Would it not be their sickness on the death that cut them off so early? Would he be able to agonize over the millions of other beings, not quite little children, fetuses for whom there was no place, and over the mothers who had been able to convince themselves with the support of the society what was growing in their bodies in any case had no inherent right to a place, and over that society? Would he share doubts about God, about man, about life, about every absolute? Could he understand why we cling to expectations that are no longer affirmed or confirmed by experience, why we repress the most essential questions? Would such a Christ understand failure? Could he participate in our failure? Or is he eternally above all that? Do we have to do with him now only as the risen and glorious one who has put all that behind him, magnificent with answers, and himself the answer, as he ascended far above the misty flats of our questions?
You wanted to say something?
Well, I'm just going to respond. I am a pastor from Monticello, Iowa. And 35 miles to drive. This current year, we've had two young families in the church, which broke up their marriage and remarried. And they found it necessary to transfer to another congregation. Everything you're talking about. And I mean, that's what happened. So yes, there's a failure to do that.
Yeah. Amen. Go ahead.
Well, I would like to respond to that as a parish pastor, that I think those experiences are true and do happen. I think just as often the other also happens, where people are caught up in either failure or tragedy would say that the church is the place that gave them the greatest support, that they did find caring communities. And I've seen that happen many times.
Yeah. I would like to sign an incident that has caused our church, I think, grow. About 8 years ago, we had a pastor come to our church who had been divorced. Well, now, of course, that is something, you know, everybody else can get divorces, but not pastors. And we on the council were a little nervous about, and I just, how are we going to present this to our congregation, you know? How are we going to say we are issuing a call to a pastor who has been divorced? So while we're talking to him and trying to find out how we could tactfully make the announcement to our congregation, he said, don't bother, I'll tell him. So he got up and very point blankly humbled himself about his divorce. The congregation voted. He had 7 negative votes. This was a congregation of 600. And our church has grown more since he was there, and I think really one of the reasons is the very fact that he admitted that he was so supreme. So, I mean, I think that's a good sign. So he accepted a call himself to another church far away. And I had asked him, are you going to tell them you're divorced? He said, certainly. I mean, this is a part of his charm. I don't think his sermons were all that good. But I do think that the congregation loved him dearly. Now, what they loved him for, I don't know, but I mean, didn't he just
the thing that makes me a little uneasy about this portion of the conversation, as I suggested even the other night when we were on a different issue, is that it's so easy for us to kind of trot out our personal set of statistics, examples, our kind of private poll, as President Johnson used to do, to confirm that finally, well, you know, things aren't quite as bad as Hall wants to suggest that they are. And very difficult for any of us, one of our failures, to get a sense of the wider picture. It's encouraging to hear of those individual examples. I think what Hall would like us to do is to look at the continent and ask what the churches are doing. And there, I don't think we fare very well.
Yeah, his guess is that no matter what we do, the church's establishment is going to go downhill from here on. Mm-hmm. It's going to be more and more a remnant, and he's almost certain that this kind of theology would help that process.
Yeah. Go ahead.
As a follow-up on that, I wonder if it isn't sort of a growing number of divorces within the clergy. Our daughter belongs to a church that their pastor was divorced and remarried and stayed in the same place. And I asked her if it had been any problem within their church, and she said, no problem at all. So, you know, if this isn't a growing thing within the church, and not only this, but also the... I think it's rather, I guess I was surprised to find out that a call committee now will ask the pastor if they have a drinking problem, mm-hmm. and citing that many of our neighboring pastors around here do have a very serious problem. You know, this type of movement must show that the church is becoming very cognizant of problems.
Their members.
Well, go ahead. All right, especially the art movement, like to show another side that does happen to deal with divorce. Also, I read in Dallas papers before I came up here that there's professors, I believe that's from the Walton University, Southern Methodist University, had, I version of this. It's a case where there's a couple read a book that approached him, and a couple wanted, and what was devised was a church service where their divorce was solemnized for a community basis, and the families in the court, how much this helped the individual involved bear that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would be a danger to trivialize, to minimize the importance of divorces as a symptom of some changes. On the other hand, it seems to me that we too can trivialize the point that Hall is making if we dwell on a kind of really private issue, if you understand what I mean by that term, rather than... larger corporate.
I agree that has a lot of power for pastoral care, this kind of theology, but his basic thrust is that the American dream, the big picture.
Could I throw in a quick question here, a kind of adversary question to maybe help sharpen and clarify this too? It seems to me that there is a common human urge, and it's one toward human wholeness, it seems to me, for affirmation, for a pursuit of excellence, for positive achievement. And in what sense, if you people would respond here, does Hall seem to undermine that? Do we kind of then simply kind of throw up our hands and indulge in mediocrity? Does it become soon a requirement that a pastor be either alcoholic, divorced, or you know whatever, in order to qualify, you know, for...
I mean, let's not pretend that people we're burying aren't dead, and that, you know, people are living whose marriages are falling apart. I mean, I think that would...
Okay, but isn't a lie, too, to deny that a pursuit of excellence is a good thing, that it's an affirmation of our humanness in its best sense?
Huh? Yeah, I agree with that very much, and I worry about the same point that you're making. All I can think of are two kind of contrasting passages from St. Paul, and I'll go back to Hall to get started with one of them. Ludicrous scenes are repeated Sunday after Sunday, churches full, but lately not so full, of self-made business and professional people whose whole life centers around the ideas of work, effort, and mastery, singing hymns about the total dependence of man and the futility of his work. Persons who bear the burden of office, wealth, and power in their communities, listening to such readings as 1 Corinthians chapters 1 and 2,
Not many of you were wise according to worldly standards. Not many were powerful. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even of the things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are, so that no human being might boast in the presence of God. The irony is that these scenes were not and are not experienced as being in the least ironic. And Kierkegaard had the same thoughts about Denmark. Evidently, and these passages were also dear to Luther. Evidently, there is an overturning here. There is a transvaluation of values. It's saying, make sure what you're boasting in when you're feeling good about yourself, and so on. It's growing out of grace, not something that you have achieved, not something you put together, you've not earned your particular spot in this excellent fellowship.
Let me just try to tell two stories. I want to celebrate, first of all of the places where the church really does become a community of support in the midst of our failure. We don't have to cultivate divorces among clergy or drinking problems to qualify. We have enough other failures to be able to deal with. But let me tell two stories. A couple of years ago, we had a student from South India at the seminary, and I went around to a bunch of parishes and raised some money for this student, and one of the checks bounced. And so I waited a couple of weeks and then called the pastor of that parish, and I said, among other things in the conversation, by the way, the check you sent us for so-and-so bounced. Oh, he said, I'm glad to know that. He said, we've been trying to discover all these checks. I want to tell you what's happened. This is a small parish, 100 families, less than 100 families. He said, our treasurer has embezzled $15,000. And I was just stunned. And then as he told the story, it got even more complicated. The man had lost his job, couldn't find another job, couldn't face his wife and children with loss of job, and couldn't come to the parish either with loss of job. So since he was treasurer, he just embezzled over a core period of almost a year, $15,000. Most of it from the church's debt retirement fund, that is, from their mortgage to the bank, but picking and choosing those checks that he didn't think could be easily traced as ways in which to cover the embezzling. I said to my friend, what are you going to do with all this? He said, I don't know. He said, it's more complicated than that. We've got insurance, but only if we prosecute this guy can we collect. Well, they agonized for 2 months, finally decided not to prosecute, and they worked it out as best they could, and people came up with money so that they could get the bank out of the picture and a few other things. But it wasn't just simply a case of not prosecuting a fellow Christian. They really worked at attempting to restore with all that meant. Now, this is over it's about 3 years ago now that it's happened. And my last conversation with the pastor just before we left is that it's working. I mean, they put together some psychiatric help for him, first of all, some family counseling. I was at the church about a year and a half ago when the man's daughter was confirmed. A great celebration. They stayed with that parish. He's got a job again. He's paying back the money so that it isn't, I guess I worried as we were talking here that what was going to happen was kind of cheap condoning. One of Lewis's best quotes is that of all the powers, God forgives the most and condones the least. And how we put that together, it seems to me, is part of what we need to be talking about. Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's one of the stories that needs to be told I think that's a value to be cultivated. But I guess all the studies I have at my disposal indicate that those are the kind of rare examples. I hope they're not all too rare, and I will rejoice with every story you can tell like that. But the big picture. The other story I wanted to tell concerns the religion of the Midwest, football, and a poignant picture. Michigan and Ohio State were playing for the annual championship of the Big Ten. I don't know what they do with the other eight teams, but they were playing. And Michigan's field goal kicker missed a couple of crucial field goals, and Ohio State won the game. And what was really poignant for me was the shots that the television cameras focused on. There was one quick shot that I don't think they were really supposed to let on. It was the Michigan field goal kicker sitting all alone on the bench after he had missed his field goal. Not a soul within 10 feet of this guy, you know. I was reminded of Kennedy's statement about victory having 1,000 friends and defeat having none. And the contrast to that was the Ohio State field goal kicker who had just won the game with a field goal, mobbed by everybody. The time at which you need nobody is when you've kicked the field goal. The time when you need everybody is when you've missed. But we just reverse that. We just reverse that. We all want to be in on the victory, and I do it. You know, that's the most terrible thing. I want to be in on the good things, and I want to avoid the bad things. But it's just the reverse of what it is. What would it be like if we cultivated the pursuit of excellence, you see, in ways that weren't so much scorekeeping? What if we cultivated the pursuit of our personal ability to live with ourselves, to handle leisure time, to fight par at golf, or bowl against 300 instead of against somebody else? You know, I just wonder what it might be like if we could, if those were the kinds of things we cultivated, and if the time to rally round somebody was when he blew it and not when he really didn't need it, when he had made it. You know, when I have preached a good sermon, I don't need anybody to tell me it was good. I know it. It's the lousy ones that I need people to stand around and say, "We love you anyway."
I have two lines and then I'll stop. In a dark time, the eye begins to see. Faith is fear that says its prayers.